Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Utah Governor Cox said he'd welcome an ICE detention facility. Here's what state leaders are saying now that one is reportedly in the works. No food stamps. Why federal shutdown will lead to more empty shelves and empty bellies for Utahns. And a tug of war between growth and historic preservation intensifies in a rural Utah city. And we are joined on the program today by Salt Lake Tribune Data Enterprise reporter Megan Banta. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. We also have with us reporter Jordan Miller. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And politics reporter Robert Gerke, hopefully, will be joining us here shortly. Here he is. Let me admit him to the Zoom here. So we're glad to have everybody here for the program. Robert Gerke joins us. Robert, thanks.
Hey, happy to be here, Tom. Sorry, I was running a little bit late. Technical issues.
No worries. Let's start with you, Robert. Like to start with this, just to treat this briefly. Probably won't take us long to talk about this because nobody in the state's talking. Here's the headline. Yeah, Utah Governor Cox said he'd welcome an ICE detention facility. Here's what state leaders are saying now that one is reportedly in the works. What are we hearing?
Not a whole lot, to be honest. Governor Cox said Governor Cox spokesperson said that, they haven't really had any conversations with the with ICE or about the detention center or the Defense Department. Part of this is CNN reported that the Trump administration is looking at opening 10,000 bed detention centers for migrant detentions, pending deportation, and ICE wants to put these on defense installations. And so the thinking is maybe Hill Air Force Base, maybe something like that. But again, the governor said that they haven't had conversations about it. DPS said they haven't heard any. Department of Public Safety said they haven't heard anything about it. And congressional delegation is quiet. So we don't know a whole lot. But this is something that we're going to be continuing to follow. Obviously.
The governor had previously said that he would welcome a detention center in Utah that would prevent, people being transported to Las Vegas.
Yeah, when undocumented immigrants are being deported, they are processed out of Las Vegas typically. Utah doesn't have a processing center, so they end up having to send them all down to Las Vegas. Which takes a lot of time. Now, the governor said in 2024, before Trump was in the White House again, that he would support having a detention facility here. But he also said back in earlier this year that there hasn't been any movement in that direction. That's what he said earlier this year, and obviously that kind of falls into line with what he's saying now about how they haven't had the conversations that are giving birth to this story, I guess.
Oh, a quote from the story, and you worked on this with your colleagues, Jose Dalva IV and Emily Anderson Stern. Some fear such a facility would help President Donald Trump's administration speed up detentions and deportations of undocumented people living in Utah, including those without criminal records. I guess if you build a facility, I was going to quote Field of Dreams, people will come, people will be forced to come, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're obviously trying to build this because they feel like they need it. And the ICE spokesperson said, because they are processing so many people through the system, that they are looking at all of the options to accommodate, I guess, the influx of people that they're deporting. And it was kind of interesting. There's a quote in there from Steve Erickson, who is a Citizens Education Project. And he says that, this is something this significant, 10,000 bed detention facility is something that the public would expect there to be some transparency on. But he filed an open records request to Governor Cox's office, was told that there is nothing responsive. So, it's kind of, I guess it's a mystery right now, obviously one that we at the Tribune and I'm sure others elsewhere are going to be trying to get to the bottom of. But it would sort of stand to reason, I think, that yes, as the ICE spokesperson said, because there are so many people that they're processed, that they're having to move through the system for deportation, that at least again, these would be holding facility. Presumably, people wouldn't be held there for an extended period of time, but they've got to have somebody, someplace where they can put these people before they can send them back to their country of origin or elsewhere.
It was odd, at least to me, to learn that contracts for many of these are going through the U.S. Navy, the Supply Systems Command. I guess that's just where things flow.
Well, it's an interesting tactic, and again, this is something that was reported by CNN first, but if you put things on federal land, or especially on military land, if that's where they want to put these, presumably it makes the process a lot easier. You don't have to do like the same amount of contracting stuff, feasibility studies, environmental studies, things like that, and you don't have to deal with local or state governments to do that either. I mean, they can move them into these military installations at will, really. So that's the assumption, I think, that it would just sort of streamline the entire process and help them get this in place a little bit quicker.
Well, we'll see what happens, I guess. Let's move to another story. Here's the headline: Should Utah's Supreme Court justices be allowed to hear cases they've advocated for? We've had the first, I guess, day of hearings for nominee John J. Nielsen, and he, ha in private practice, he's argued some cases which may well come before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, this was kind of an interesting. So they're doing 2 days of hearings on his nomination. I think you guys talked about it last week or the week before. But John Nielsen is a judge on the Third District Court. He was a law partner of Tom Lee, former justice of the Supreme Court, and a conservative, a pretty one of the more conservative members on the court when he was on the court. They were law partners, and they in that capacity they filed some briefs and some pretty controversial cases, right? They were the counsel who handled the defense of the state's ban on transgender girls playing high school sports. And they filed a brief both in the Planned Parenthood case, which was the law that banned most or tried to ban most abortions in the state. And they were also the counsel, or they also filed a brief in the redistricting case, particularly pertaining to the attempt by the legislature to amend the Constitution to allow them to repeal ballot initiatives. And so, Senator Stephanie Pitcher, during his hearing, asked him about those particular cases. She was particularly, I think, expressed concern, or exp the question was, you've been involved in these highly politicized or highly political cases, can you then, move to the bench and rule on those, or would you be recusing yourself from those cases, assuming they come back to the Utah Supreme Court? And Judge Nielsen said that, he can't commit to doing something ahead of time, right? That's not when you're going through these confirmation hearings. It's fact specific. He's got to see, when it arises. But he said he would follow the rules this established for the judiciary regarding recusal. And if he needs to recuse himself, he would.
He'll recuse himself if he needs to. He also brought up, as you I think you mentioned there, Thurgood Marshall, right? Argued many civil rights cases, then became a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, that was what Senator Todd Weiler brought up, sort of in Judge Nielsen's defense. Thurgood Marshall was a attorney for the Nash NAACP for many, many years. That's sort of how he made his name, and then became a Supreme Court justice, a U.S. Supreme Court justice for the, I believe, 60s, 70s, and into the 80s and early 90s. He ruled on civil rights cases in that capacity. And Senator Wyler's point was, I believe that you and Judge Nielsen actually reiterated this too. He made his name in the civil rights realm, and then as a justice ruled on many of those cases, it brought perspective. He felt like Judge Nielsen said he felt like to have had that experience in the civil rights law field, and then to be approaching it again from the bench. He said it happens, and the other point Judge Nielsen made is like, you have people who've been defense attorneys, you have people who've been prosecutors, and they end up on the bench and they're handling criminal cases, for example. Just because they've been a defense attorney or a prosecutor doesn't mean they can't do the job impartially. So that it was just kind of, I think, more than anything interesting that he has been involved in these very controversial cases, and I think it's worth noting that he's been involved in these controversial cases exclusively from sort of the more conservative Republican side, which is with the current climate between the judiciary and the legislature. I think the legislature is probably refreshed to see that. You know, that's kind of what they're looking for.
One more thing on this. You note that Judge Nielsen describes himself as an originalist. And so in his brief in the abortion case, he drew on newspaper articles, for example, from the 1800s, looking at what people thought about abortion around the time the Utah Constitution was being ratified.
Judge Nielsen's described himself as an originalist, as you mentioned. So that means that you look at what the meaning of the words in the Constitution meant at the time the Constitution was ratified. And so in their brief, which was done, their client for this one was a group called Pro Life Utah. They looked at newspaper articles from the 1850s to the 1940s, and how the term abortion was used. And their argument is that in the time that the Utah Constitution was ratified in 1896, nobody viewed abortion as a right. It was never used in that context in popular vernacular. It wasn't used that way in newspapers. It was used most often, they said, as something that warranted criminal prosecution, frankly. It was seen with disdain, and so their argument was that because of that, they have to, I guess, assume that that abortion was not viewed as a constitutional right at the time of the ratification, and so it shouldn't be read into the Utah Constitution, and they have to, you know. So they were arguing that the lower court judge who enjoined or blocked the state's abortion ban attempt erred in his judgment because he was reading into the Constitution a right that didn't exist at the time it was adopted.
So Judge Newsom will have another day of hearings. I guess what is it on Monday, and then they'll vote.
Yeah, next week he'll be back before the committee. The committee will recommend his confirmation to the full Senate, and then the full Senate will vote on him, and it'll be sworn in presumably if everything goes as I would expect it would. Like I said, I think the legislature is looking for somebody conservative for this position, so I would expect that the Republican legislature would adopt him easily, or confirm him easily. So I think that yeah, that's the timeline, is this hearing next week, and then on to the full Senate for a confirmation vote.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, and we're talking with politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, let's treat one more story, kind of a complicated story, so maybe unfair to have you do a brief version of this. A very interesting, though, landscape company says Utah AG's office raided it to divert attention from Sean Reyes' ties to Tim Ballard. They're seeking $1 billion in damages. Give me kind of the Cliff Notes version of this one.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thing that jumps out with this story is $1 billion in damages and possibly more than that. So this company called Rubicon, it was based in Bountiful. In 2023, the Attorney General's office raided their offices, the Secure Strike Force raided their offices as part of a sort of culmination of a 6-month investigation into alleged human trafficking. They filed charges against the company, its executives, seized the assets, you know, seized records and so forth. This went through the courts for quite some time. Back in 2024, I believe it was, they went to the judge and said, "Hey, the affidavits, the evidence that they used to pre they presented to the judge to get the warrants to raid the offices, is totally bogus." They argued that They were accused of, taking away, they were bringing in migrant labor, and they were accused of taking away their travel documents to keep them from leaving. They were accused of having forced them into renting company housing. They were accused of threatening to deport them if they didn't work long hours, et cetera. And Judge Rita Cornish had this evidentiary hearing called a Franks hearing, and he sided mostly with the Rubicon executives and said that that it the evidence shows that the investigator either made false statements in the affidavit or he was had reckless disregard for the truth. And she right after that, shortly after that, the Attorney General's office dismissed it. Well, the company says that damage that it was done to their reputation, they lost business, et cetera, plus the legal fees that they expended in trying to defend themselves, warrant was due to a malicious, intentional prosecution by these individuals in the Attorney General, formerly in the Attorney General's office, in the case of Sean Reyes, who's the chief of criminal investigator. And so they're saying, well, we're entitled to compensation for that. They say that compensation should be $1 billion. Again, this is just a lawsuit. This is just their complaint. There hasn't been a response. These are the allegations they're making. But it is a big deal in terms of, like, obviously the scope of the money that they're trying to recoup, but also the sort of the narrative of the malicious prosecution that they said violated their constitutional rights. And I'm sorry, that wasn't a very short summary
Oh,
like
no,
you asked for.
it's a kind of a complicated story. I guess another thing that stood out to me is the if the plaintiffs were to win here, the state would have to shell out the cash, I guess.
Potentially, yes. I mean, so it's frequently the case that when government officials acting in their government capacity are found liable for this, the state indemnifies them. Obviously, that's something that's going to have to be litigated. But if the state is held liable, yeah, it kind of comes from taxpayers. There's risk management. The Division of Risk Management sort of handles these issues. They have insurance, and then the legislature would have to come in and pay whatever is left over if the court decides that's the direction they want to go. But that's obviously, like I said, a big if. I think down the road a
Right.
ways, we'll see how it plays
We'll
out.
see how it plays out. Yeah. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he'll be back with our underplayed stories a little later in the program. We're going to head toward a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the week of the news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And here's the headline we'll be talking about after the break. No food stamps, why the federal shutdown will lead to more empty shelves and empty bellies for Utahns. We'll be talking with Tribune Data Enterprise reporter Megan Banta. Hope you join us following the break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune, Data Enterprise reporter Megan Banta. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, morning, Tom. Thanks for having me
Good
on.
morning. So here is the headline: No food stamps, why federal shutdown will lead to more empty shelves, empty bellies for Utahns. This, of course, is related to the federal government shutdown. What and we have a, I guess, a kind of a deadline coming up, a new month, where I guess if nothing happens, thousands of people in Utah will not receive those benefits.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I'm not sure even if something happened today, if stuff could get out exactly on time. So I think at this point we are looking at nothing for November, and a deadline coming up pretty quickly to get people those December payments and get them through the holidays.
How many people in Utah do we estimate would be affected?
It's a little shy of 170,000. So, in the most recent kind of year that we have the data for, it was 169,300 Utahns. And, our household size is a little different than other states. It's about 86,000 households.
The WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children, that will still have money, do we think, or do we know?
Yeah, that one is covered by some contingency money that's out there, but I don't know how long that will last.
So you talked with Gina Cornia, executive director of Utahns Against Hunger, and she said this is why we need a functioning federal government. She doesn't know how we're going to handle this, right?
I mean, I think she just either, there's a level of frustration, obviously, in her world fighting against hunger, and seeing, disagreements lead to that, putting people's, livelihoods at risk and their ability to feed their kids at risk.
What is the state saying? I guess people are going to have to go to the food bank.
Yeah, that was the state's recommendation, in the initial announcement that they made, and the state has now, said that they will donate to help food banks, which, the food banks are saying that they really need, because as they get more demand, they need, they need to be able to buy more food to supplement. They need to be able, they need to have more volunteers too to help distribute more food, and they need more money to help, like, run more trucks and get more food down to, southern Utah and up to northern Utah and over eastern.
Was the food bank say they obviously you're saying they need help, but do they think they can handle this coming influx?
They think that they can help with it, but they can't meet that demand on their own, especially because they've been seeing increased demand already, since really the start of the pandemic.
Interestingly, we'll refer people to Mark Emsley's story, I think published today. She went and talked to some people, bishops and et cetera, with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I guess some religious organizations might have to step in as well.
That was something that the head of the food pan the head of the Utah Food Bank recommended, that Jeanette Bott said, some people might be able to look to their church, whether that's LDS or, another denomination. But even she said even those pantries are going to need help from the public. Nobody can really deal with a sudden influx super easily.
So what the food banks, what kind of help again do they need? I guess money, volunteering, anything, I guess.
Yeah, so what they like to say is, dollars, food, and time. So food, especially, I mean, they think people kind of think of like green beans and everything, but what we've always been told is like get canned meat and like condensed milk and, things that families can use to like make really nutritious meals, and not just kind of like, cans of beans. And then money to kind of help them buy a little bit more food, but also help them with their distribution, buying more gas, for trucks and whatnot, and then coming in to help and actually distribute the food if you have time.
Gina Cornia was urging people to call their Congress people. She says there's money USDA could release, I guess, if directed by Congress.
So theoretically, there's some contingency funding, through USDA, but from what I'm, seeing, it sounds like that money is not, either there or there's not a willingness to release it for that.
So if a person has a need, where can they find their food pantry?
So I mean, pretty much the easiest one is 211. So either calling that and talking with an operator or going to 211utah.org. And then there's also some stuff on emergency food resources, through Gina Cornia's, the organization Utahns Against Hunger.
So we're talking with Megan Banta here. Thanks for telling us about this one. I'd like to go to another story. Of course, you cover housing quite a bit. Here's the headline, interesting headline. I don't want my grandkids to be in Indiana. This is Governor Cox. So he was speaking recently. What's he talking about there? His grandkids in Indiana?
So I think he was recently talking with one of his sons, and he chatted at this Ivory Prize Summit on Wednesday about his son showing him a listing for a 3-bedroom home with I want to say 2 baths, and it was 275K. And everyone was kind of like, in Utah? And then he clarified, no, it's in Indiana. And kind of saying that we're at a point where we have a failure, that young people here are having to look outside the state to find their housing, As a native Hoosier, I was glad that he clarified it wasn't anything against Indiana, kind of more of a distance thing, which I understand because it's a 4-hour flight and there's only one direct flight.
You quote the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. They say the median listing price for a home in Utah, $590,000. That just blows my mind. And so that illustrates, especially people just starting out, just can't afford a home.
Yeah, and that is actually down a tiny bit from the last time that I looked at those numbers. I think in May it was 595,000, and we were the seventh highest in the nation. So that median is coming down a tiny bit, but it's only doing that in a couple of counties.
So what are the sticking points? I guess, higher interest rates, I guess, would need to come down. What else to kind of unlock this problem?
Yeah, well, so the interest rate one is interesting because I've talked with experts who say, as interest rates start to come down, you get more demand, which then pushes prices up. And a lot of people actually recommend kind of buying now while prices are a little bit higher because, there's no guarantee that they're going to immediately come down, but interest rates more than likely will. And you can refinance. So the real thing that needs to happen is just we need to have more supply to meet the increased demand that is not going away.
So last year, the governor announced plans to add 35,000 starter houses to the housing stock. How are we doing?
Yeah, we're if you kind of do the math in your head that by the end of 2028, you'd want about 7,000 homes a year. As of September, we're at Five like 5,800. So we're a bit behind, but he's also said, there are a bunch of kind of papered lots, so lots where we can build housing, like their permits are in, there's the ability to put a house in pretty quickly, but there's no infrastructure to get there. So we need to get some infrastructure down, and then that could unlock a lot of homes to help with, the gap that we're seeing right now at 5,800 when we want to be a little closer to 14,000.
The governor mentioned regulation. He says we need to deregulate. What does he have any suggestions?
He didn't suggest anything specific, but they've talked a lot about making it easier to build ADUs or making it easier to bring in modular homes, which people kind of think of trailer homes, but really it's just a standard house that's built in a factory. It can be built a lot quicker, which makes it possible to be cheaper, and then it's brought and kind of assembled quickly on site within a day or two, generally. So things like that, just to make it easier to build in certain places, and like increasing density allowances to make it easier to build more housing instead of just building 4,000 square foot homes, actually being able to build smaller starter homes.
I think this was last week, Megan. You had a story with headline: Utah may be 235,000 homes short in 30 years.
Yeah.
Related here, what's the legislature looking to do?
Yeah. I mean, for now, to kind of be able to get their hands around the problem a little bit easier, they're looking to kind of defragment a lot of the state's housing efforts. It's, there are 40 different housing programs. They're scattered throughout like a few different state agencies, and a couple of like different organizations that are related to the state. So kind of just trying to get most of them under one department other than things related to federal programs.
We've been talking with Data Enterprise reporter Megan Banta. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem.
We'll have her on a plate story of the week later in the program. We'll go to another break next, and after the break, we'll be talking with reporter Jordan Miller. Here's the headline: A tug of war between growth and historic preservation intensifies in a rural Utah city. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in next Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jordan Miller. Jordan, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you. So here's the headline: A tug of war between growth and historic preservation intensifies in a rural Utah city. Where are we talking about?
So Spring City is about 2 hours south of Salt Lake. It's kind of a little bit south of Fairview. It's in San Pete County. And it's a really historical pioneer town. They have a lot of buildings that have been a little bit like upgraded since, of course, the pioneer times. But a lot of the residents are very, very proud of the historic buildings they have on their properties. Like there was one barn that I visited that was essentially just kind of like the Lincoln Log type manufacturing build, where not really many nails were used. It was just all the logs fit together. And they have kind of used those homes for tours and buildings for tours. And just they've had these homes since they were originally built, and since Spring City was originally settled, and they've taken care of them.
It's about 1,000 people, right? Kind of a small community. And I guess, a lot of towns have some historic buildings. Spring City is a unusually well-preserved kind of a original pioneer town with a lot of those original buildings, I guess.
So Spring City is a relatively small town, but the entire town is listed as a National Historic District. And that's a designation that brings in tons of money and grant funding and tax credits to that town. It's a pretty rare designation. I want to say Gettysburg also has it. But it's kind of there's a lot of national historic buildings there. Like it's a lot of buildings there are on the National Register of Historic Places. And the most of the town, if not all of it, is a like a National Historic District.
The before we get to the current crisis, the I guess the town council took an action a lot of residents don't like. The standard lot, I guess, is 1.06 acres, and this was kind of a typical, Latter-day Saint pioneer lot. You could have your home, you could have barns, an orchard, a garden. I guess that was what they liked.
That 1.06 acre lot is what they call the Mormon landscape. It features all those outbuildings like small home cabin, root cellar, outhouse garden, fruit orchard, barns, just like you said. And many of the properties that are still there today retained a lot of these historic outbuildings. Like I went into someone's root cellar, I went into someone's fruit orchard, and it's really beautiful to see.
So what did the town council do that's got people riled up?
So over the summer they initiated a plan to or they proposed to cut down the 1.06 acre lot size, which is the minimum lot size in Spring City, to a half acre. And that was really concerning to a lot of people. It really stunned a lot of people because they have tried to do this before many times, the city has. There have been a couple of different referendums that have been forced on the issue. And the end result has always been that the residents really want to keep that 1.06 acre lot size. So after the city council proposed that, there was a public hearing that lasted more than 3 hours. And so many people were concerned that decreasing the lot size would damage the town's historic reputation and could threaten the historic di district designation, which could also threaten, future funds that could come towards to the town for different projects and things. And a lot of people also feared their homes could be devalued and that the city's infrastructure just couldn't support the additional development that could come with half acre lots. There were some people who were very pro decreasing the lot size. One Spring City Council member really wanted to make sure that the city could address growth challenges and affordable housing in the area. And a lot of people who I talked to understood those concerns, but they wanted to do it sustainably. And they also said that there was some other residents that also believed that, property owners should have the right to determine what to do with their own land. And reducing lot sizes would give landowners the ability to divide their properties and sell portions. So if they have, a child who wants to return to Spring City, and they can't afford to buy their own 1.06 acre property, Maybe a family could subdivide their lot and have their child return home and live in a house right next to them.
Yeah, interesting themes here. You see this played out, you know, all over Utah, all over the nation, I would imagine. I guess they tried to come to something of a compromise.
Yes, there was a compromise initiated. So essentially, that compromise was there would be a protected zone of 1.06 acre minimum lot sizes. But that lot size or that protected zone would not extend to the National Historic District boundaries. There would still be some of the town's National Historic District would be in the minimum lot size of a half acre. So that was the attempted compromise. And many people who I spoke with were still concerned because they didn't like the boundaries that were proposed. They felt that they were arbitrarily designed and didn't really understand what constitutes the protected zone versus what wouldn't, like why that decision would be made. So that was the attempted compromise. And that was considered just recently. The ordinance was approved by the council recent in I want to say like a few weeks ago. That compromise was so there will be a protected zone with a minimum lot size of half acre outside of that protected zone.
Now, the mayor, you talked to Mayor Anderson, he doesn't have a vote on the council, right? And I guess he's trying to get people to come to a compromise that will stick. I guess that's what he wants.
Yes, exactly. I believe he even kind of postponed the potential decision on that ordinance, or at least tried to, because he really wants the city to be able to come together on this. Whenever I spoke with him, he very much seemed like, of course, he wants to preserve the historic nature of Spring City that everyone knows and loves, but he also understands the concerns of some residents who really want to be able to do what they want with their own property. So he was really urging both sides to come together for a compromise.
Several council members are up for a re-election, I guess, here shortly. So I guess the lawsuit could be rendered moot if people throw out the current council and a new council votes a different way.
As far as I know, that it is going to the lawsuit. Whenever I spoke with the plaintiffs a few weeks ago, they said that the lawsuit was going to move forward. Essentially, the ordinance. They were planning to do a referendum if one of these ordinances were to pass. And the city council, actually, in an interesting move, they unanimously approved that compromise ordinance, which means it's not subject to a referendum, according to Mayor Anderson. And so there's still a few council seats that are up for election this fall. I think the mayor's office is also up for election this fall. So essentially what he told me was if a new council comes in the spring and they decide they want to either reverse the ordinance or change it, they have a path to do so.
Yeah, interesting story. Like I said, these themes are being fought over over many areas. Thanks for telling us about this. We're talking to with Jordan Miller. Let's move to another story, Jordan. Salt Lake County Republicans moved to slash subsidized childcare by year's end. So I guess the county is subsidizing childcare in some facilities.
So the county has four childcare centers that are in Kearns, Magna, Mill Creek, and North Salt Lake. And those centers serve 271 families during the school year and upward of 300 during the summer. And that's all for kids aged 2 years old to 12 years old. So they were looking at the current financial situation for those childcare centers. And currently, the county offers deeply discounted childcare at about $460 a month per child for kids ages 2 to 4, and $290 a month for kids ages 5 to 12. That's about half of what non-county facilities charge, according to a study that was conducted by the Pathway Group, which is a consulting firm that was hired by the county.
And childcare can be a big factor, right? Whether you could even, go to work, etc. According to your story, both Republicans and Democrats on the council are unanimous in saying that in its current form, these centers are not sustainable. Why are the Republicans saying they're going to have to, I guess, end? Are they shutting down the centers?
So they voted to eliminate the centers, but there will be that was essentially a they held that vote so that they could give people notice because the final decision will come in December whenever they approve the final budget. And if they eliminate these centers, of course, in that meeting, which I believe they plan to do, considering they had the 5-4 vote to eliminate them already, that means that people will have just a few weeks to find childcare. So they wanted to see where they were right now so they could start handing out notice to families that these childcare centers will close. And the reason that they're at this point, the study that they presented during the city council or the county council meeting on Tuesday showed that the facilities were at or near capacity pre-COVID around 2019. But since 2022, post-COVID, fewer children have enrolled in the program. Inflation has made food and staffing a lot more costly to keep those centers running. And then federal dollars that have supplemented those county costs during the COVID-19 pandemic ended last year.
So the Democrats voted against this, but they agree it's maybe not sustainable. What do they suggest?
Yeah, so there was a kind of a compromise resolution proposed by Councilmember Suzanne Harrison. She suggested that the council go ahead and approve the proposed 20% fee increase for these centers, but they also would plan to close them like in the first quarter of 2026, by the end of the first quarter of 2026. So they would kind of have more of a sunset deadline. But that plan failed along party lines, 5-4 vote. And Council Member Amy Winder Newton had mentioned to me in a phone interview that kind of giving a longer deadline there would result in kind of it being problematic to retain the current employees that they have through the end of that program. So, of course, if people would know that that program was coming to an end, they are worried that provide like people help the childcare providers would leave and find other positions.
Private providers are saying, well, we have spots open, but I guess the problem for a lot of families is it's more expensive.
Yes, that was one thing that was mentioned is just like I said earlier, the county's facilities offer childcare at about half of what non-county facilities charge. So that was one of the things that was brought up. A CEO from a childcare facility company in Salt Lake, or they have 9 facilities in Salt Lake County and dozens more across Utah. It's called Great Beginnings Academy. He mentioned that they have availability for people to send their children there, their facilities and others, but that it is more expensive. Families, however, that do receive money from Utah's child care subsidy, which I think it's about 17% of the people who use the Salt Lake County facilities get some money from the state. Could use that subsidy that they get at other childcare centers. And the state would likely make up any difference in cost, according to Mr. Anderson, the CEO of Great Beginnings.
All right, thanks for telling us about this. We have a couple minutes, maybe time to briefly treat one more story, Jordan. Here's the headline: Widow of the No Kings shooting victim plans to sue. DA expects charging decision soon. Of course, this was a year ago at the No Kings protest. Or 4 months, right? Not a year ago, but 4 months, the previous No Kings, not the latest one. Tragic death of Afa Alou. Now his widow is applying to sue.
Yes, she announced that during a news conference this week with her lawyer, Jim McConkey, and the rest of their legal team. And she said that she plans to file a lawsuit to achieve accountability in her husband's death. It's not yet known who the family would name in the suit, but she really wants to get accountability for her husband's death and make sure that this doesn't happen to anyone else.
It's interesting that the lawyers said that they would decide, I guess, who to sue upon discovery. They're gonna, and that highlights the fact that the District Attorney Sim Gill has not charged anybody at this point.
Mr. McConkie had said that his client hasn't received any word on the case for months from the DA's office. And he also had mentioned that he was disappointed in Salt Lake City's response because they had been looking at for documents kind of about they had requested documents about the protest and who was involved and what have you. And apparently they only received a one-page permit with the organizer's name redacted. So they're hoping to have subpoena power to get more information about what actually happened, according to or what really happened, according to Jim McConkie.
We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jordan Miller. Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, it's time for our underplayed stories of the week. We'll start with Robert Gerke. Robert, what's your underplayed story?
Jose Davila and Addie Barrett did a story yesterday about what appears to be an ICE arrest at the Salt Lake International Airport that was captured on film. Plainclothes agents were detaining a woman at the airport. It's created a little bit of a backlash. The mayor's criticized it, criticized ICE for doing this in plain clothes, et cetera. And the video is, shocked some people at least, and to, and so you can check that out at sltrib.com. It just kind of goes to the question or the issue we were talking about earlier with the detention facilities and et cetera. And so, but yeah, that's at sltrib.com.
SLTrib.com for that one. Thank you. Megan Banto, what's your underplayed story?
Yeah, Jose also gets a shout out for mine. He's got a story about the plans for a potential trail network that would link everywhere in the state and make it possible for people like safely bike places. It'd be the first of its kind nationwide. So that'd be really interesting if that comes to pass.
The so-called bike freeway, I guess this would
Yeah.
eventually link what Logan to St. George. You could do that. SLTrib.com to check out that one as well. Jordan Miller, what's your underplayed story?
Yeah, this is a story from Julie Jag that I found very interesting. The headline is "This Utah Ski Area Will Let You Skip the Lift Lines, But You'll Pay For It." So it looks like Solitude is implementing almost like a fast pass-esque priority line for people who want to bypass the log jam of lots of skiers getting ready to ski on a power day.
All right, to check that one out as well at sltrib.com. All the stories we've been talking about, sltrib.com. Well, and behind the headlines today, we have been talking with the Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too. Data Enterprise reporter Megan Bant has been with us. Thank you, Megan.
Thanks, Tom. Always a pleasure to chat.
Thank you. Pleasure. And reporter Jordan Miller has been with us. Jordan, thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. And you have been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time.